There have been, you know, mob attacks by groups of Palestinians and groups of right-wing Israelis, sort of all over the country, kind of thing where, you know, if, sorry, mom, you're not supposed to hear all this. Where you just, you know, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's good enough. And, you know, that kind of random ethnic, religious, nationalist, however you want to describe it, and it probably flows between those categories all the time, really threatens to, you know, just destroy whatever form of coexistence and existence, not coexistence, whatever existence was there. And I'll just jump ahead and say that, you know, I've long believed that that the conflict in all of its forms has not been ripe for any sort of resolution because it's so comfortable for Israelis, which isn't to say that I wish upon my family or anybody I know the kind of destruction and terror that people in Gaza are feeling and experiencing, or what's going on in, you know, the cities of Jaffa and Lod and Akko and these other places. But it's inevitable. You know, when you, I don't need to tell anybody here that you know, when you keep people under oppression for so long that, you know, it tends to bubble up. And Israel has this horrible expression of like mowing the lawn every few years to sort of like, you know, bring that down through force. But you know, that doesn't last. I meant to be talking more about the media here, but sorry, I just have to say that it's crazy. It's worse than I've seen it in a long, long time, if ever, through my eyes. I started out by mentioning what I thought was good coverage by the New York Times, and that there was blind spots there. And there's two directions I want to take that in. One is that people from the outside, and probably a lot of people from the inside, tend to have a hard time connecting what happens in the 67 territories and Gaza and East Jerusalem and the West Bank and what happens inside 48, Israel proper, as we tend to refer to it. And to me, the past few weeks have shown that it is impossible to completely separate them, despite the best efforts of consecutive Israeli governments by putting up walls and fences and, you know, limiting movement and declaring, you know, different legal statuses on the different territories, because we've seen them all come together. That, you know, from people in East Jerusalem to all over the country, inside Israel, the West Bank basically joined in the past few days. And it's the same struggle. It's the same outrage. It's the same thing driving it all. And in the past, there has been more separation. And that's what the New York Times got wrong. Not by, you know, by omission, by focusing almost exclusively on the Al-Aqsa stuff and Hamas joining in from Gaza. But you can't disconnect the two, because on the Israeli consciousness, from the government and down to the regular citizen, I think people are, you know, just as preoccupied with what's going on in Israeli cities. And there was just no mention of that. And that's something where the Israeli narrative has really permeated the way that the international media in particular, I won't get into the Hebrew-Israeli media because that's a whole different story, how they've just sort of accepted the contours of how this story goes. And it's something that I think can be changed a little bit here. But again, you know, even when I see good coverage, it's just totally not seeing that. When I try and explain the way that the Israeli media treats the Israeli narrative, I usually make a comparison of, you know, would you expect the Wall Street Journal to give you anything but a capitalist point of view? And of course not. And that's what it comes from. That's the parallel for me. And I think the mainstream international media, for the most part, even if they're critical in a lot of ways, accept the basic premise that, you know, Israel and the Palestinian territories and Gaza is separate from, at this point, from the West Bank and East Jerusalem, even though they, you know, will constantly give these caveats that it's, you know, occupied, treat it as part of Israel. It's, you know, they accept that. The other thing I wanted to talk about the media, and the international media in particular, is two events that we saw in the past few days. One, you may have read about these, New York Times covered them pretty well, and I have lots of criticism about that because of the attention that they got, which is, the first was the Israeli army spokesperson essentially using the international media as a diversion tactic or a decoy in their assaults on Gaza a few nights ago by slightly ambiguously and then outright saying that a ground invasion had begun in order to, you know, push Hamas fighters into defensive positions where they thought they could get them. And the second was the bombing of the AP and Al Jazeera offices in a Gaza office and residential tower yesterday. I'll start there because it happened just a few hours after this family of eight children and two mothers were decimated in an airstrike. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm sitting here, me and my family left Jaffa a few days ago to the north of Israel where things are a little bit quieter. And so I'm watching my Twitter feed and all of a sudden nobody's talking about this family that's decimated anymore. That, you know, I didn't check the number of people killed before I got on here, but you know, nobody's talking about the huge, you know, death and destruction that's taking place. And all of a sudden it's just about, you know, empty foreign newswire offices. And again, it's this narrative. You see it in just the way that the stories are told, that it's more important that an AP and Al Jazeera office got bombed, as far as, you know, hierarchy and headlines and stories and storytelling, than it is in to tell the stories of these of the people who are really impacted by the horrible things that are going on. And that ties into the first part where, to the first incident of the invasion that didn't happen, because again, you have a foreign media that's shocked that a division of the army is telling them things that serves the army and not them, which to me is just indicative of, you know, they're not being critical in the right ways and in the right places. They're relying on the Israeli narrative far too much, even when they're doing good work, in order to tell the story, which obviously does a huge disservice to anybody who's trying to promote not just the Palestinian narrative, but a more just, real, and And you know, getting information out there that can mobilize people and get governments to act and you know, I'm not in a very optimistic place, but you know, somehow make a difference. So I feel like I've been very scattered here. Forgive me for that, because it's a very difficult time to try and make sense of all this. But I'm happy to focus on any specific areas that you guys want to talk about, whether that's directed or just as in a Q&A format. There's a lot going on, and I'm happy to talk about it all. Yeah. Sure. Yossi?
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for doing this report. Now in this kind of despair, it's, you know, we're talking about the destruction and death, but I saw, how can I say, a sign of light yesterday. It was not huge, but still, and I read in the magazine that you have been editor, but the Hebrew version, Local Call, about events that took place in many places in Israel of Jews and Arabs standing together on different level. And I maybe if you can elaborate on this, I assume you've been aware about this. And absolutely, if you can at least tell us about this part of the reality of people are not sitting, hiding in their home with despair, but also going out to the street in different places. And I just have a question about this. I'm right now in my computer, I'm pointing to this. So I wonder if you're all interested to see pictures of those demonstrations, if you can give me a share, or we can go to Michael, if it's okay with you guys.
Yeah, sure.
If it's okay.
Yeah, Yossi, I made you a co-host so you can share.
Okay.
So yeah, again, I'll start with my what I'm most familiar with, which is what's happening. Sorry, go ahead.
And I believe it's right. Can you see the pictures?
We see the screen, but no pictures yet. There you go.
Okay, let me go here. This is the local... Local Call in Hebrew version. And the first picture that you see is from downtown Tel Aviv, organized by a group called Standing Together and Hadash Party. And they were, according to them, it was around 1,000 people standing there. What it said in Hebrew on the right side in purple, we're not going to go back. We will demand peace and equality. On the left side, it's saying Gaza and Sderot, children want to live. I think in Tel Aviv was the largest event. This is a picture from Jerusalem where the police attack the same group of people. And broke the demonstration in a very violent way. It's also from Jerusalem. And here it's written, Ben Gvir, you know who is Ben Gvir. You're not gonna fire our city. This is one of the demonstrators in Jerusalem was arrested by the police. This is in... also from Tel Aviv, as I read. And this is Ayman Oda speaking to the crowd, and he said beautiful things. Maybe Michael can tell us. And this is from Yafo, city of Jaffa, where you are, yeah. Michael. And one of the Palestinians in Israel said, where is the reasonable Jewish voice? And this is in Haifa, city of Haifa. This is in Lod, not too many, but still some people decide to stand up there. And this is in, I'm not sure where is it. It's somewhere in the Galilee, in the north.
The Western Galilee.
We're gonna continue to live together in the Galilee. This one in the north part of Tel Aviv. What it's written here in Hebrew, I'm also ashamed of the national law. I assume you all know about this. And you know, surprising, this is Palo Alto, California. They're all keeping, this is interesting, they're all keeping this standing together sign, which is purple, this is a color. And right here, it's in between Nazareth and Nof HaGalil, you know, the Nazareth is the Arab town, Nof HaGalil is the Jewish town, which is now I can call it Jewish Arab town. And this is in, anyway, you got the taste. I'm gonna go back to you guys. I try to figure out how I getting out of this. I have to go back to Zoom and is anybody remember how I'm getting out of this? I don't remember.
The top of your screen, it should say stop share.
Stop share, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it took me out.
No, on the right on the top where there's a green bar.
Oh, stop share. Okay, you got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
so, just welcome back.
Anyway, yeah, if Michael, I hope if you can add more to this because.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And thank you for bringing it up. It's true. I was talking with some friends about it today, that if there's any silver lining about having these things happen within our own neighborhoods, which, you know, is not usually the case, it's that people not only, I think, have more of an incentive to go out, but it feels like there's something more to do. And I think that's why you're seeing such these kind of protests all over. There's also definitely some inspiration from all of the anti-BB protests that have been going on all, you know, for the past year, basically. This and through the pandemic, which really taught people to how to have hyper-localized protests. You know, we had these restrictions on not going more than a kilometer from your house, and people understood that you can still have mass protests if you get, you know, 50 people on every corner throughout the country. But yes, there's absolutely some hope there. We're also seeing, as you mentioned in some of those photos, very, very aggressive police suppression of any sort of protest that's not of the right-wing nationalist Jewish supremacist variety. There's been a strong, strong sense that the police are enabling, at the very least, those elements, which have been, you know, bringing a lot of the violence and a lot of the tension. But yeah, it's inspiring to see that happening. I'll just one note about the ones in front of the National Theater in central Tel Aviv is that protest was actually supposed to have taken place in Jaffa, but the police told the organizers that their official language was they weren't able to, but what everybody understood is that they weren't willing to protect the protest from right-wing elements, as we'll say, to tie that into what you guys were talking about the protest in front of the Federation or the embassy yesterday, the consulate. It's, on the one hand, you know what, I'm actually going to talk about Omdim Biyachad, Standing Together, the purple sign people that Yossi mentioned, because I do think that they're an inspiring break from the disappointing political organizing on the, I'm not going to call it the Israeli left, but the part of the political map in this region that believes in a shared future. Coexistence in Hebrew is dukiyum, and the common sort of pejorative way to talk about groups that promote coexistence over the past few years, particularly as everybody understood that a peace process is non-existent, if not a joke, or you know, just an act, is to call it duki, which you guys can understand in English as well. And I think a big part of that is that the political left all but disappeared. And the only thing that was left to sort of represent those types of views were human rights groups, which are not political groups. So you have the, you know, essentially no political home. You have political parties that have no power. You have human rights groups that have no political interest, and a bunch of people with nowhere to express what they're trying to do. The major movement that filled in that space in the past was Peace Now. But again, their sort of main, you know, thing was the peace process that is no more. And then Omdim Biyachad, Standing Together, came, and they had the idea inspired by mostly Podemos in Spain, but other movements around the world, to create not a party and not, but a movement. And they've done a ton of local organizing all over the country. They have joint Palestinian and Jewish leadership with, you know, leaders all the way down in the Nakab and the Negev, in places that you rarely see political groups engaging in, to the north and the Galilee, and of course the major cities in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and the center of the country. And they've really managed to mobilize people. They almost single-handedly were responsible for stopping the mass deportation of African refugees a couple of years ago by, you know, just bringing together cross sections of society that wouldn't normally come together for political purposes, and by not aligning themselves specifically, even though they kind of came from Chadash, by not specifically aligning themselves with the political party, have really been able to create a big tent to come to mobilize around important issues. And here, you know, it's not all them, but I think it is indicative of the fact that there are a lot of people who don't have anywhere to express their outrage at what society and the country and the regime, if we're talking about, you know, Israel beyond its declared borders, has become and what it is, and their, not only their despair, but their demands that it not be that way. I hope that addresses your question, Yossi.
Thank you. I see that Dick and Raquel each have questions. Dick had his hand up first, and then Raquel.
My question is about the La Haba and La Familia. They're hardly ever discussed in the American press, but it's my understanding that most of them are settlers from the West Bank. Some are from within Israel, and they have played a major role in cities within Israel in attacking Palestinians who live there. And I noticed Shaquille, if he's still on this call, he was the MC of this big rally yesterday. And that rally, as we talked about at the beginning, just got a little bit of coverage buried in the second section of the LA Times, whereas the American equivalent of these guys, the Proud Boys, was above the fold on the first page, a detailed profile of one of these leaders of one of these racist movements. So any thoughts on the role of these right-wing kind of fascist squads in Israel? And I know in some cities they're armed and they work closely with the police.
So many things to say.
Okay.
I'm going to start by saying something that I hate when other people say, which is it's a little bit complicated, but I will explain. There's a few different groups at play here, and they're all more or less the same, but they're not. Lehava is a anti-assimilation group, which started out a few years ago by basically, you know, I think we're all aware that nationalism and racism tends to attach itself to protecting women from the other. So, I mean, I say that in quotes and with as much eye rolling as possible. They set out to reclaim women who had been wooed and lured by Arab men into relationships, and to essentially save the Jewish people by those types of actions. They were known to use some violence. They're led by somebody who is, you know, was a disciple of Meir Kahane, who, you know, was declared a terrorist, and his organization was declared a terrorist organization in the United States and Israel. He was, you know, a big part of the JDL, which was, I'm sure you all know much of the history there, killed no small amount of people in the United States and Israel. A lot of the people who went on to be with him when he moved to Israel and became a member of Knesset were responsible for and convicted of, and many more arrested but not convicted, in shooting attacks and bombings and, you know, plots to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque. Very, you know, as it, you can't get more right-wing terrorists than they are, than they were. So one of the disciples of Kahane is the leader of this group, Lehava. In the past few years, since 2014, when they started during the Gaza war then, they've been building their ranks. They generally aren't actually mostly West Bank settlers. They work the same way that gangs do. They go for ultra-Orthodox young men who have been pushed out of their communities in some way, and generally disadvantaged Mizrahi youth, you know, Jews of Eastern or Arab origin, you know, young men who want to feel empowered. And so they give them a baseball bat and make them feel empowered. Then there is what we're seeing in Lid right now, in Lod, is actual settlers from the West Bank responding to calls from groups like Lehav. Oh, I should mention that these right-wing terrorists are in the Knesset right now. They will be a part of the next right-wing government if there is one. They're at the peak of empowerment, more than they saw during the era of Kahane, I would say, because he was, the right-wing pushed him away at the time. These guys are being brought in, whether it's for ideological reasons or practical political reasons, doesn't matter. They're being empowered by the people in power. So in Lod, they were actually invited to come with weapons. They put out calls, settler organizations put out calls for people with, you know, military experience, with combat experience, with weapons licenses to come to the city and protect the Jews of the city. One of the scariest things that's been happening here is, you know, the things you hear about driving massacres, like you had in Rwanda, where just like the rumor mill is flying with, you know, it's impossible for me to say what was true and what wasn't, because a lot of times these things don't even come to fruition. But, you know, in Palestinian WhatsApp groups, you had screenshots from Jewish WhatsApp groups saying, you know, we're going to come and burn mosques. And in Jewish groups, you had screenshots from Palestinian groups saying, you know, we're going to come and, you know, start burning Jewish houses. And that's how they rally the most extremist elements on both sides to come to the defense of their people, to create anticipation of violence, which is ultimately a self-fulfilling prophecy, especially when you start bringing in, you know, armed groups from the outside. And yes, in Lod, they are occupying the former municipality building. And they've set up a command center there. the videos from inside, you know, with, you know, a mix of police and armed settlers just, you know, milling about and escorting each other. Lod has been under a curfew for the past week, and these guys have been allowed to just sort of roam around, and seen no few number of videos of them, you know, throwing stones at Palestinian homes and people right next to cops who do absolutely nothing. It's, you know, exactly what we see happening in the West Bank, just subbing in soldiers for police, but actually the same people, the same settlers. And yeah, you know, it's easy to grow an extremist movement like that at a time like this, when everybody feels insecure, when everybody feels powerless, when everybody feels under attack, and really everybody feels insecure and under attack. You know, in my son is in one of the only binational, bilingual education systems in the entire between the river and the sea. And there's a community that sort of built that and maintains it. And so I'm really in Jaffa. I'm exposed to the fears and anxieties and harm that's being done to everybody, and everybody's feeling it. That said, only one side has the backing of the state, and that backing is expressed through allowing right-wing gangs to participate, and also by sending in this unit of the police that basically exists to keep Arabs and oftentimes ultra-Orthodox people in line with force, with brute force. The closest parallel I can think of is riot police, but they don't respond to riots. They basically come in to create riots. They come in with batons and rubber bullets. And, you know, there was a protest right in front of my house last week. And, you know, you see these guys, they're in, you know, paramilitary. I mean, America has become as the capital of militarized police, but these are really just extensions of military units under the command of the police coming in to occupy areas and just shut down any sort of expression and counter narrative movement.
Just, I want to add one thing. It's hardly been covered in the US press, but one media outlet, KABC or ABC News, had a interview with Tamer Jafar, who I believe is a famous rapper, Palestinian rapper from Lod, and he was the star of the movie Junction 48. And he really pushed back against the interviewer on KABC, on ABC News. So I'm not sure how in the world that got on, and whether the producer who managed to secure that interview is going to keep his or her job. But there's a tiny little bit of information that has come out in the US, which probably reflects some internal differences at the foreign among our foreign policy establishment, but it's just pure speculation.
So you reminded me of one of the most important things I wanted to say.
There also was a very good piece on MSNBC yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that.
So Dick, thank you. You reminded me of one of the most important things I had planned to say in my spiel that got distracted by myself, which is that from multiple angles, I've seen an increased willingness, both by the usual, let's call them friendly Jewish analysts, but also by the mainstream media, to just a little bit more than usual center Palestinian voices. It's Tamer, they're familiar faces to me. Maybe you know a lot of their names. It's Mariam Barghouti, it's Diana Bhutu, it's Rami Yunus. You know, it's a lot of Palestinian analysts, writers, journalists, activists who have zero patience for speaking in the how do I say this the right way? for bullshit. You know, they're insisting on telling the story the way that they see it, the way that they experience it. And I've seen that more in the past few weeks than I have in probably ever. And I have to say that I've been impressed by a number of left-wing Jewish analysts that I know who have, I don't know if there was an organized effort, but I've heard a lot of people say, like, I am not accepting any interview requests. Anybody who requests an interview from me, I'm just telling them to talk to a Palestinian. And I think it, you know, it's this much difference, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're not changing the way that the world is hearing the story, but any progress on that front, I think is something that we need to appreciate. And not only that, but, you know, excuse the cliched metaphor, but when you see a crack in a wall, you pry at it, you know? It's an opening.
I think you're underplaying it, Michael. The New York Times, you talked about its story, but right next to it, there was another story about what's happening in the Democratic Party. And there is a big shift. And another place where there's been constant, deep, pretty good information is Amanpour, who has a nightly show, and almost every night or every other night, she's had a Palestinian on, or someone who at least has that point of view. So ABC and NBC and CBS, but certainly MSNBC and CNN and PBS and places like that are having pretty decent coverage.
I think Raquel is waiting patiently to be talked. So.
Yeah. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Great. Yes. First of all, Mike, thank you for all this really important information, because obviously we're not hearing it from other sources. I wanted to just mention something about Omdim Biyachad. I looked at a recording of one of the meetings, and it was speaker after speaker after speaker, and not a single mention of the word kibush, occupation. And I found that really very disturbing. It was all about kind of, we need to be able to live together, 48ers and us. It was all about the men ruling this country and who've ruled this country for many years. So it was, I mean, but they didn't really deal with the issue of the occupation, which of course is a no-no word, right? You can't even mention that word in Israel. So I just wanted to share that with people. Yeah, they're a great group, but there's a big deficit there. The other thing I just wanted to mention, this morning on NPR, Rami Yunus was interviewed and he really did a great job. So people might want to try and listen to that.
I'm not gonna go and defend the Standing Together movement. I'm not a part of them. And while I found some of their actions inspiring, I have plenty to criticize them about them as well. I would just point out that I think they're trying to just build their ranks in a way that acknowledges the difficulty of focusing exclusively on the occupation. And I hope it works and that they're able to swing back around.
Tony.
I don't know. Yep.
Yeah, Mike, thank you very much. And to add to the general thing too, I noticed that 972 has been getting a little bit more exposure. Dalia Shanlin was quoted in the LA Times in an article that they had, although it didn't identify her as being, a writer for 972. And Chris Hayes on MSNBC a few days ago had one of the writers, a Palestinian woman who whose father, I guess, used to be the imam of a mosque. And she was paired with an Israeli journalist not associated with 972. And I've just seen little bits, you know, you used your fingers like this, it's just a little bit of the truth tellers beginning to get on to the national networks. And I take that as a sign that there's an awful lot of empathy and corrective thinking that's going on in the big journalistic places. So, you know, I think we need to keep pushing for that. And the you mentioned that one Jewish journalist who said, "I'm just refusing interviews. Call a Palestinian. Talk to a Palestinian." I think we just have to start doing that. Whenever anybody asks us what the situation is, say, "Oh, I know a fellow. You can talk to him. He's Palestinian." So,
yeah. Lori, we have not heard from you yet, and you've been raising your hand for a while. I see everybody else is also.
Thank you. First, thank you. And thank you for being there in the middle of the whole craziness and keeping your sanity. So, thank you for that. And I just want to add a few things for what you're describing, because I'm looking at it a little bit from like 20,000 feet above.
Yossi, Uri, you got to get closer to your microphone.
So, what I'm looking and what I'm seeing and what I'm reading, I think part of the whole thing there is a realization, at least in certain parts of the Israeli populace, especially the younger generation who uses all the devices, they're starting to realize that something is funny. It seems to be repeating itself. And they start asking questions. So I sent you, some of you, an email. Orly Bar-Lev, I know that you heard the name. She's been in the Balfour demonstration for the last few years. But she basically gave a chronology of basically anticipated situations. She started saying that the moment Bibi got his mandate, he started laying the grounds. And she gave chapter and verse what Bibi does, what the Israeli police does, and all that thing, including leading to that police raiding the mosque in the middle of a prayer and throwing at them grenades, concussion grenades. So some of the people in Israel are starting to realize that something is off here. It doesn't make sense because the whole thing doesn't match. Now, there's another element we see is basically how Ben-Gvir, all of a sudden, one person, is basically throwing so many matches into the whole thing, and Bibi supports him. So people start wondering. Now, as far as, this is a couple of more remarks. You said something about the left in Israel. I always contended that the whole conversation about the left in Israel was actually a fictitious conversation. There's no real left in Israel, very few. I mean, aside from the Hadash, and the whole idea is that the moment they started shooting, everybody, the whole Zionist panoply, all of them said, yes, we support the government, we support the army, do whatever you need to do. So this is a reflex. This is a reflex that's been around for a long time. Even Meretz and all the people that we think they're leftists, they're basically Zionists. The moment you say that you're Zionist, that's it. There's no room for the other there. Because the Zionist thing basically says that the Arabs, whatever, the Palestinians, they're interlopers. We need to get rid of them one way or another. And this is something which is missing, I think, in the conversation as a whole. To realize that the Zionist doctrine basically doesn't allow room for the Palestinians. The best, they can be third-class citizens as long as they obey. So this is something that always been missing for me in the conversation for the last, I don't know how many years. So another thing we're talking about, I saw Ali Velshi and MSNBC.
Just to respond to your last point in one sentence is, I agree. For you history buffs, or maybe some of you, those who were there, I don't think there's been a real left-wing party in Israel since Matzpen.
Oh, listen, I know some of these people personally. They were friends. They called me the bourgeoisie. I was the bourgeoisie with the Matzpen people. But Matzpen basically is now in London. They moved to London. There was another thing you talked about. I just watched today Farid Zakaria this morning. He brought Rashid Khalidi and Martin Indy. And Rashid Khalidi basically says, hey, you can't start a history from last week. The 1948 people who were settled in Sheikh Jarrah, the whole thing hasn't been resolved. And they basically try to pretend that that issue doesn't exist. And as long as you don't deal with it, there's nothing going to happen there. And the Israeli government, I mean, the Israeli government, especially in the last 20 years, it's the policy of containment. They call it containment. In other words, we're going to fight with them every 5 or 7 years. No big deal. It's okay. It's a calculated price we're willing to take. I think the escalation that happened with the Israeli Arabs, I think was a miscalculation on the side of Bibi. He didn't realize the depths of the discontent of the young people. That's my idea. So that's why the whole fury came out in surprise, because people thought that the Arabs accepted the deal. Okay, we'll be third class citizens as long as you give us some economics. And I think that scared a lot of people somewhere who are not Bibis. This is my analysis, the way I see it. It's kind of like Bibi has been trying to push this conflict to be an issue, a religious conflict. It's a Jewish Muslim, and we've been fighting for generations. The truth, from my perspective, it's a political issue. Israel, since 1948, knew the price in order to settle this thing with the Palestinians. The Israeli government, since 1948, were not willing to pay the price. There is a price to pay, and they know the price. And it was clear if they didn't know it, 1994, the Oslo agreements, the whole thing was spelled out. The Israeli governments don't want to pay it. Containment works for them. Every few years when you have a fight with the Arabs, it's terrific. It's good for us. It gets all the patriots behind us. So this is really satanic plan. And on the other hand, I understand the politicians always kick the can. So here's my observation on that thing. It's going to happen again. Now, the United States and Biden, he needs it like another hole in the head. The wrong timing for him. I mean, he's basically want to get rid of it because the other issues, and he knows he's been around since 72. He knows that this is not something that any American politician can solve. He saw the slew of American presidents fail one after the other. So I don't think that this is going to end that easily. And the fact that they opened another front with the Israeli Arabs, the Palestinians, that's not going to bode well. Now, the question, what's going to happen with Bibi? Because he's an instigator. He's basically using Ben-Gvir and Smotrich as instigators. He wants to keep the whole thing boiling because otherwise he goes to jail. So I can talk about it for a long time, but essentially, if people don't deal with the basics, when you get into the weeds, you get lost. So, Michael, thank you again. Guys, thank you for the indulgence.
One of you, sure. Jeff, Yossi? Whoever speaks first.
Some of this is you know, I'm about to say is not directly. Anyway, thank you. That's the first thing. Thank you, Michael, and I just want to say one thing that is a little relevant to what you were talking about. I watched Amanpour the other night. I try to watch it every night to see who they're bringing on in relationship to this struggle. And when Noura Erekat was there, I noticed that Amanpour does the same thing she does all the time, and that is, she responds to the speaker like she did to Noura by showing me that she's not hearing what she's saying. her questions don't get us in deeper into what the issues really are. Her questions somehow divert attention away from what Noura and other Palestinians who or somebody who holds a Palestinian narrative says. And so anyway, I just want to say, when we listen to some of these news commentators, listen to some of the questions they ask in response to what a Palestinian narrative is. They don't expose in a deeper way what the issues. Okay, the second thing I want to say, and this just the talking has brought all this up for me. I lived for 3.5 years in Ramallah during the first Intifada. And I saw on a regular basis, and it's scary, the settlers coming into Ramallah with the military to protect them while they smashed car windows, they slit tires, they threw stones through people's houses, just individuals. And you know, you never knew what the cause of it was, but it happened on a regular basis. And so there's a history to this. You know, just like we talk about the historical foundations, when I was teaching this, I taught, I gave students so excerpts.
The flames.
What? What's it?
All right.
Dorothy, please mute yourself.
Hi.
One of the things that I did is I had students read excerpts from Herzl's The Jewish State. Okay, and we can talk about what the ideology now is, but it goes right back to him saying the Jews everywhere in the world forever, in the past, the present, and the future will be persecuted. And if you start with that mentality, it leaves you no room to hear anybody else. And so there it is in the voice that goes back to 1896. The other thing I wanted to say there's two more things. One is that walking the streets of Ramallah on a regular basis, the Israelis that were on the rooftops in our city at that time regularly dropped those percussion grenades in the streets. And I know how bad they are in the streets. And when I was teaching at the Ramallah Friends School, they came into classrooms, the military did, and shot CS gas and percussion grenades inside buildings. They're lethal inside buildings, the CS gas. I don't call it tear gas because you don't tear up. You choke up. You can't breathe in or out. It's like somebody putting a chokehold on you. But indoors, and I'm thinking now of Al-Aqsa Mosque, when people are praying and they start shooting the percussion grenades in, it almost explodes your eardrums. It knocks you over. And it's just like referring to rubber bullets when they're really rubber coated metal bullets. You don't get the full impact, sadly, through language. You almost have to experience it directly to understand what must have gone on in the mosque when they shot those percussion grenades. It must have blown people's heads up. Okay, and then the final thing I wanna, this is a question that's relevant to what you're saying, Michael. And that is that what percentage of readers in Israel read Haaretz? And because I mean, I read Haaretz English on a regular basis, and I'm just wondering how much exposure the actual Jewish Israeli public or even the Palestinian Israeli public get of Haaretz. Do you know that? That's all I have to say. Thank you.
I mean, I can. The last time I saw any figures on it, they had about 10% of the newspaper market. I don't know how that translates into number of, like, percentage of the actual population. But not a lot, you know, it's not a lot. It's one of the reasons that at 972 we started a local call, just to try and, you know, expand the number of people who were exposed to that. And, you know, again, not to come to the defense of standing together. One of the best strategies that we found for reaching those people and bringing them into that conversation was through issues that are not directly related to the occupation, but are sort of humanitarian, civil rights, other issues that for somebody of conscience, somebody of the left who, sees all those issues as intertwined. But, you know, I saw a right-wing journalist say this the other day that, you know, it's one of the greatest ironies of Israel is that most people from a socioeconomic standpoint are on the left in Israel, but they don't, that's not how they vote. That's not what they vote on. So it's, you know, a lot of these groups are trying to latch, to get an in, to make inroads into those populations through other issues that aren't directly related to, you know, occupation is only one manifestation of it, but yeah. Sure. Yossi?
Yeah, in response to what Rachelle raised about the issue of occupation, I listened to Ayman Oda in this speech in downtown Tel Aviv, where 1,000 people, and I can quote one sentence for him. He said, "The people who are here, or this war is not between Jews and Arabs, is between Jews and Arabs together against the brutal occupations and for peace and equality." And for this statement, he got a standing ovations. You know, he's a Palestinian who citizen of Israel. He's the head of Hadash and the joint list and parliament member. But many people share his view. As far as the standing together, what I know about them, because I know a lot of people there, this is a grassroots organization. It's a multi-issue. It's not just issue of the occupation or human rights. They define themselves as a alternative grassroots socialist grassroots movement, and fighting the occupation is one of their issues, not the main issue. But what they did this time, because of the anti-Arab pogroms and some, I can say, criminal elements among the Arabs who attack Jews or synagogue, they felt that in this moment in Israel, beside the issue of the bombing of Gaza, there is a desperate need to show that Jews and Arabs, in spite of all this, can stand together even on a basic thing, so of being together with each other and saying something in a common voice. You know, if I can compare it to white people and Jews who went to the South during the Jim Crow or during the civil rights movement to show that blacks and white can stand together against segregation and against this. And I think if we can compare this, we can understand why it was very important to show that Jews and Arabs can be together after all the events that took place inside Israel. I think it's not just the issue of occupation. There are some terrible thing happening inside Israel, and they wanted to show this as far as this. So I just wanted to add to this.
And I'll add to that that, you know, the past year and really the past few months have challenged the traditional paradigms that we see Jewish-Arab political engagement in Israel in ways that we haven't seen, that I've never seen. Maybe they, you know, existed many, many years ago, but I don't really think so. And I'm referring to something that nobody really knew how to understand or deal with, which was that, you know, the joint list, which is the joint list of Arab political parties in Israel, breaking up because the head of the Islamic Southern movement, or Mansour Abbas, basically saying, like, I'm not going to limit my political activity by the contours of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm going to fight for the interests of my community. And, you know, we'll see what we can get done. And he said he was willing to sit with Bibi or with a left-wing government or anybody. And without getting into whether that would have been a good or a bad thing, and, you know, this current violence is showing the limits of that kind of cooperation, because, you know, even somebody who was willing to sit with Bibi in a government is not willing to do so while he's, you know, pummeling Gaza with bombs while Israeli police are raiding the Aqsa Mosque. But it really, you know, it shows that there are other ways to organize for a more just future. And actually, I think it's, you know, taking, decentering the occupation from that conversation is actually, or could actually be a positive development if you're somebody who does not believe in the two-state paradigm, who doesn't think that it's viable and that ultimately everybody's gonna have to live together as equal citizens in one state or one entity, however it could look. So I think actually challenging those paradigms, as troubling as it can be because of the many ways that it can be manipulated for bad, can also be a force for good.
Mike, there's a couple of questions and comments in the chat box, and I thought that since we're coming up on an hour and a half, we're at an hour and 15 minutes right now, if you could respond to them. Randy Hein-Lam had a chat question right at the beginning. What problems does being both a journalist and an activist create for either role? And have you had threats because of your positions during the rise of this nationalist fervor? Sort of a personal question there. Another question was, do you think this might lead to some kind of a coalition movement? Could a new centrist left government come out of this?
I'll start with that one because my answer is no.
Okay.
Actually, I'll just go backwards the whole way through. I have not had any threats personally to me. I was the editor of 972 for 7 years. I left a year and a half ago, both to, because I felt the need for a new generation of voices to sort of take the lead. And I think that they've done an amazing job of that in the past year and a half since I left 972. So my voice is not as high profile on these issues in that time since. That said, I'm still a part of the community of writers and people in 972 and Local Call, and particularly the Palestinians who have been going on Israeli TV day after day. And to their credit, they've been doing an amazing job. If you saw, you know, what Rami Yunus has been doing in the English language press, he's also been doing in Hebrew, saying the exact same things with far more aggressive and belligerent questioning. And you know, several of them are staying in hotels because they're getting threats to them and their families. You know, the type of stuff that we're seeing, it's, you know, people are seeing graffiti outside of their houses and thinking that their homes are being marked for attacks later. And nobody can say that that's not true. I don't know if it is, but you know, we're in a situation where the risk is real enough that you have to take that kind of thing seriously. So no, I haven't received those kind of threats, but people that I'm friends with and colleagues with and deeply care about have. The problems with being a journalist and an activist, I haven't answered that question in a while. I don't know how to do it any other way. It's and honestly, I come from, my career has mostly been in areas where I've been able to be open about it, but I've also, you know, I'm close friends with a lot of people who work for mainstream international outlets, and their political views are not very far from mine when it comes to Israel-Palestine, but they have to do their writing in a slightly different way. But that is, their journalism is activism. I don't know anybody who gets into journalism that doesn't see it as activism in some kind of way. Whether that's for a specific cause or just to make the world a better place, like, you simply don't accept that low level of pay and, you know, disparagement from the general public unless you really believe that it's a force for good in the world. So my approach to that has always been that maximum transparency mitigates any damage that coming at it from a particular angle can have, because yes, you know, 972 and the other type of work that I've done in the past is quite clear about who we are and what we believe in. But I think as long as you're upfront with people about that and you're articulating smart views and you're doing your work according to transparent and solid ethical foundations, journalistic ethics, that people respect that. I certainly know the journalists from the other side of the map, and they're fairly open about where they come from too, whether it's just by identifying as Zionist or more than that. They respect it also. You know, they're willing to engage in conversation and to respect me at the same level that they see themselves. Can't hear you, Tony.
What about Eric's question? Could a new centrist left government come out of this?
Oh, no. I can explain why, but the answer is no. I don't think there's been a possibility of a center left government in Israel for, well, since Bibi managed to make an end run around Tzipi Livni, however long ago that was. Mm-hmm. The math just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
The parliamentary system here is fragmented into a constantly changing mosaic of parties, but the blocks, as they call them, of the sort of ideological divisions that separate those parties, even in the center, doesn't change very much. And when it does, it shifts to the right.
Right. Dick and Jeff have their hands up, so why don't we take them in that order, and then we can wrap up, Jeff, okay?
Okay, I'll go real quick. Yesterday in Los Angeles, there was a very large march. By my estimate, maybe 10,000 people. It was a very, I would say it was a Palestinian nationalist march. The flags were, there were a few non-Palestinian flags. I saw an Armenian flag and stuff, but it was very nationalistic. And I wonder how this, if there's any bridge between this and the people for Omdim Biyachad, because it struck me as this was the tenor of this march was the people who are opposed to any kind of normalization. I mean, there was no discussion of, there a little discussion of US foreign policy, a tiny little bit, but no discussion about the progressive element in Israel. Do you think this can be bridged, or it's just too parallel nationalist movements?
It is until it isn't. You know, until you give somebody another flag to wave, they're going to raise the one that they have. You know, this has been my, when I used to make such analyses, this was my analysis of why Bibi keeps winning also, is that, you know, he's selling fear, but nobody's selling hope. So present a vision and get buy-in from the Palestinian, you know, street or leadership or civil society or academia or whatever, but like, you know, create an idea that people can stand behind and then try and get people to stand behind it. I don't like nationalism on either side. I certainly understand it. You know, I have, you know, friends that from my more on the ground activism days, you know, Palestinian friends who we would have, you know, deep discussions late into the night about anarchism. And then they get a, you know, like a Palestinian flag tattoo. I'm like, what's going on there? You know, you're getting the symbol of a state and you believe in, you know, an anarchist future. And, you know, the answer is, you know, until I can taste freedom, like I have to prioritize my struggles. So you know, the Omdim people also, like they don't exclude people who identify as Palestinian. They're very involved. They have a joint leadership. There's room for it. They try not to put it center stage because they're very much trying to create a big tent and not scare people off. But I don't think that that strategy really depends upon movements outside of 48 Israel, to be honest. it's trying to fill a vacuum that existed and exists within 48 Israel, and not quite yet, although I hope they do at some point, try and connect to, you know, Palestinians and 67 territories and diaspora. And but until then, like, you know, that's what people have to, that's the flag people have to raise.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff, we do have a question from Dorothy Reich.
You skipped me. I had my hand up, Tony. Come on.
No, no, I understand that, but I had suggested be the last one. Do you want to hold off your question until the end, and we'll take the question from Dorothy?
Yeah, I just want to say that I've been spending a lot of time on Clubhouse and chat rooms with Palestinians. And actually, one who's leading them mostly is the group I'm involved with is a gentleman from Egypt who has been working on trying to stop the U.S. from sending money to Sisi. But from what I get from these people, is they just want their humanity recognized. They want the apartheid restrictions lifted. They don't want to throw the Jews out, the Israelis out. They just want to live together. They would like the right of return, of course. They would like to get their properties back. But there's not any hatred in them. Not the people I've been. I've been in several rooms, not just the one room with Muhammad and his friends. I've been in a lot of rooms. And really, I'm struck by the kindness and gentleness and humanity of these people. And they just want their lives back. They want to be able to walk out of their houses and go to the nearest hospital without going through a checkpoint. I can't even tell you how my heart is breaking for them. And I know that a lot of you feel the same. And we have to figure this out. We did this, and we have to make it right. And I don't want to start crying.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Little side note, Khaled Mashal was doing a Q&A on Clubhouse for like an hour the other day, randomly. People just started finding him. Most people just want to live their lives. I mean, and until you convince people that there is a way forward that is not the zero sum equation that they've been told it is.
They don't seem to feel that way. They don't.
I know a lot of people that don't on both sides. People just want to live their lives. Of course they do.
Yeah, they say they want to know they're going to wake up in the morning.
Yeah. Dorothy, thank you very much. Jeff, we'll turn it over to you for your last question and closing.
I have two questions. The first is that the New York Times has a new chief correspondent in Israel, and he's been writing pretty good stuff. Do you think that this is was a mistake, or is this, do you see, as some sort of a trend?
I used to be invited to meetings with the bureau chiefs of the New York Times in my old role fairly regularly. And I haven't met Patrick. I also have been impressed, as I alluded to. However, I would also say that the previous two bureau chiefs, I was also impressed with in person. And there's a hell of a lot of self-censorship and self-censorship, not in, you know, in the sense that they just anticipate what they'll be allowed to write, or they anticipate what they're supposed to write. They anticipate what path they're supposed to walk, and they keep to it. I've seen that breaking a little bit in the past couple years. The previous bureau chief, Dave Helfinger, I think pushed the boundaries quite a bit, particularly with his coverage of the return march in Gaza. But I would agree that there does seem to be a shift for the better with Patrick Kinsley, I think his name is, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really hard to say if it was a mistake or not. You know, I don't know who the foreign editor is right now, and you know how that played into the decision to choose him, or how much vetting about his views or willingness to stick to the party line was, and how much editing they're doing of his work to rein it in or push it in either direction. But you know, small progress, baby steps. I'm happy with.
Actually, you know, you've said it's a little change. I really see a much bigger change, especially if you look over a period of 5 years. I see the Democratic Party changing. I see the secondary media, maybe not ABC and CBS and NBC, but certainly MSNBC and PBS and things like that, having a pretty good story. But the other question I want to ask is about this Palestinian Jewish working together. A few minutes ago, you said that there's plenty of people who sell fear, but no one sells hope. Well, actually, that's not true. Yossi showed us all those photographs of the Jewish Arab protests all around the country that are preaching hope. So there are people who are preaching hope. The problem, though, is, I think, is that they have no political stroke at all. As you've pointed out, there's no one, the whole political spectrum, except for the joint list in Israel, is Zionist. And the peace camp doesn't even exist, as I guess Gideon Levy said the other day, it doesn't even have a hut. There are significant Jewish Palestinian things getting together that are selling hope, but they have zero political stroke. It's just like the people who are in this country who want gun control. The whole country wants gun control, or 70-80% of the United States wants gun control, but you just don't get it because the political world doesn't. And there are a whole bunch of things in this country which is like that. The people want one thing and the political world just is somewhere else. And that's the problem in Israel.
Yeah, so I definitely was referring to the political party structure when I said that nobody's selling hope. For sure, it exists on a grassroots level. It's not big enough. I am inspired, maybe not hopeful. I'm a big skeptic when it comes to really latch on to things, as you can tell by my talking about baby steps the whole time. And even there, what I would just maybe close on is that, you know, I'm a skeptic when it comes to these things. Like, you know, I think you can have movement in a positive direction, but until it achieves something concrete, it can easily swing back in the other direction. So yes, I am absolutely very happy to see the movement in the Democratic Party in the United States until it starts to penetrate the leadership and policy and the, you know, and administration. I'm still pretty skeptical, even as much as it's, you know, huge. And I mean, huge to see somebody like Rashida Tlaib, you know, wearing a keffiyeh and, you know, basically having a teach-in about Gaza on the House floor the other day. It's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but show me some change.
Yeah, Jeff, you want me to wrap?
I'll say before you say thank you. I'm going to say thank you guys for having me and for accepting me instead of my wife. I'll be impressed by her even more.
Yeah, we look forward very much to seeing Emily talking about the litigation part of it and the actions that she's doing. And I can't thank you enough for taking your time and in the midst of a crisis right now and a situation that we hope will end in a peaceful manner and not with more aggression. So Michael, thank you very much. Jeff has posted the upcoming Zooms. Michael's wife is going to be then June the 13th, Emily Schaefer-Omerman on litigating the occupation. And the next time, please note the change. We'll be meeting on a Tuesday, not a Monday night, because of Memorial Day. We'll be talking about the Jerusalem Declaration. So, Jeff, you have anything further to say at the end?
No, see you all on Tuesday, June 1st.
Okay.
I have one more announcement. Richard Silverstein from Seattle, who's a journalist, contacted us, and he said he's available and would like to do something about the Biden administration's foreign policy. So we haven't worked out a date, but Jeff had suggested possibly doing it soon at the end of May, May 24th. So once we have that worked out, we'll add that to the schedule.
Okay. Well, Michael has left us, and God, it's good to see all of you. Thank you very much for your contributions. Shaquille had to leave because of a meeting, as did Randy Hainlin. So they had to go off and do other things.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Thank you, Jeff.